Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
He's PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys. This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books.
Books.
What's cut you off when you were going to say the one and only. I messed up 20 months in, and I messed up the intro.
Yeah, how could you? And I was going to start off with my definition of books, which I believe I've mastered at last, because I've been in this for a long time, everyone. And I believe a book is something vegan. Am I right about this? It's something you can eat it.
I think you
worms,
can.
There are bookworms, and I believe those are pesticides. Not pesticides. I think they're pesticle fellows that eat books. It's a new trend lately. So you buy books to eat. So I've been looking in restaurants, and I didn't find much. I didn't find much Shakespeare in my Italian restaurant. I'm afraid so.
Well, Shakespeare's geography of Italy never was very reliable. But if you go to an English restaurant, maybe you'll find some. I don't know.
Maybe I'll find something false Italian. Exactly. So it has to be a fake Italian restaurant. A fake Italian restaurant.
Exactly. And then you'll find it right there. Well, we're joined as always by little Alfred. There he is. And I'm distracted. I'm distracted because before we started, we were singing some book-related refrains and our new catchphrase, let's get lit up. Referring to
let's
literature.
Let's get lit. So everyone get that. That could be the new t-shirt, by the way. Just let's get lit.
It's almost as popular as Is This a Holiday?
Not quite as I believe Is This a Holiday might have a second wave of popularity now that the holidays are actually beginning.
I hope so.
In the summertime. So I hope, guys, just you can get the t-shirt online. You can actually buy a t-shirt from Books Boys. And I don't know. Can we get the t-shirt for
I'm working on that one because Patreon will only allow one t-shirt. But what you can do is if you go to patreon.com/booksboys, you can get a normal Books Boys t-shirt on some of the donation levels. And on some of the lower levels, you can get our show early. You can get Playboys. Actually, in the last month, we released two episodes of Playboys because we did our normal stuff, and we also did a Playboys extra with Alex. So we did our Julius Caesar finally came out, and
we did a lot of promo for JC, and in fact so much promo that we shortened it down to JC, and it's very obvious for us that's not about the man who you know walked the ocean, or it's about the other man who walked the earth called Julius Caesar. So that's a fun episode. And as you mentioned, we also did one. We read a Norwegian play together.
In fact, two, actually.
Indeed.
We did Doll's House and The Newly Married Couple. And one of those we released for free for a few days, or for a week, actually, on the podcast feed.
To celebrate the Norwegian national holiday. So there you go. So all your Norsk friends out there, ahoy. That's what I say.
Yeah. And also, Interviews from the Vault 13. I interviewed a country musician, Dan Reardon, many years ago, and I released that as well. So this is usually you're getting about a show a week on the old Patreon.
Nice. So guys, sign up, get it, listen to it, and buy a t-shirt.
That's the catchphrase. You got it in one.
Exactly.
Well, let's get stuck in because I read too much this month, but we're not going to cover it all.
As usual,
but I read way too much. I'll tell you why. I'm halfway through my ninth book this month already.
Your ninth book?
Yeah. Now, obviously, we're on the last day of the month, so the one I'm halfway through is going to carry into next month. Okay. I'm also going to keep another one for next month, And I read some poems of Lorca, which I'm going to do separately in a little Poetry Pals. So what that means is we've only got 6 books to cover, thank goodness.
So last month, I believe it was last month, or was it the month before that, we covered Miguel Hernández.
That's right.
The great Spanish poet. And now Federico García Lorca is from the same time period a bit earlier. We'll get into that too, I suppose. But I highly recommend, just saying from now on, both Lorca and Miguel Hernández.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about 6 books, and people will be glad to know that we're almost finished with Honoré de Balzac. I think we had a lot of Balzac.
Are you sure about that? Because I believe he did write about 200 novels. So I hope you didn't read all the novels.
No, but I'm almost finished on the little run of Balzac's that I'm getting from the library.
Oh, you're not doing the complete works. You're not doing the whole human comedy.
No.
Oh, okay.
But I did start out this month by reading some Balzac, and I read The Country Doctor. There's not a lot to say about this one, if I'm being really honest. Oh. It's very boring and uninteresting. Book.
Oh no!
Essentially, this chap goes, and we find out at the very end that he's gone under a fake identity, and he goes to meet a little country doctor. And I guess this must be part of the scenes from Country Life.
I need to explain to the ones who have missed it. Balzac wrote the human comedy La Comédie Humaine in contrast to the Divine Comedy of Dante. So the human comedy is not necessarily always a comedy. It's basically a realistic portraiture of early 19th century France. Am I right about this?
Yeah.
Of all aspects, divided into city, city portraitures, country ones. So this one is subdivided into the country, country stories of the whole human comedy.
Yeah.
Okay.
This particular one is 1833. Mm-hmm. And it is part of the scenes from Country Life, as I say. It's just this guy goes to see this doctor, and the doctor... Benassis, basically what he says is he's not in it for money. So he says, look, if you're rich, you will pay me well, and if you're not rich, I wish for nothing. So he doesn't set a price for his work. You know, he just says, look, a rich person will afford to pay me, a poor person can't, and there we go. I'm not interested in kind of setting prices for my work. But what he actually does is more than just what a doctor would do. He kind of takes over this little town, and he improves their market economy, their agriculture. He just takes over like a kind of mayor of the town and gets everything working, improves the infrastructure, roads, just everything, and really takes this little rural village and kind of modernizes it
Sounds good so far, actually. So it's an altruistic.
Yeah. Well, here's why it's not good. We don't see any of that happen. They just told us he did all of these things, by the way. So nothing happens throughout the 300 pages of this book.
Oh, no.
And there's some bits that I don't agree with, where he talks a lot about capitalism and markets and exchanges. And when a country's in full production and the production has balanced its consumption, it's necessary to create fortunes and increase public wealth. And there's a lot of little spiels about, you know, how we need production and manufacture and industrial revolution and capitalism, which obviously don't sit well with a dirty commie like myself. But
I suppose this particular novel was not among Lenin's or Stalin's favorites.
I would say not.
Wasn't in the Soviet Union, okay.
And there's a chap, Tabarou, who they kind of refer to as being a bit of a scoundrel. And he comes in and he lays the case out. And he says, look, here's something that happened. I am a cheat and a beggar and a thief, as you know. And here's the set of circumstances. And at the end, I didn't pay the guy. What should I do? He says, well, you're in the wrong, of course. And he says, are you sure I'm in the wrong? I won't win this at the courts. He says, absolutely not. He says, ha-ha, well, I tricked you because I reversed positions. I'm actually the other guy, and now you've just told me that I will win in the courts. And they're like, you scoundrel.
All right. So it does have some of the Balzac in here.
There's a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
But
I find it very funny.
It's just tricky that nothing really happens in the book. And we find out at the end, the guy visiting him wants his help, and that's fine. But he did it under a false identity. And I don't really know why he bothered, because the chap's very willing to help people anyway. And then at one point he talks about how everything will eventually turn into monarchy and the dynasties of kings, but you know, I believe in the iron law of oligarchy, so I think that every political system will turn into oligarchy, not monarchy. And then he follows the Anna Karenina method.
Oh no.
Because they say to fill pages, because nothing's happening in the damn book. So how do they fill pages? They say to the stranger,
agricultural manual.
Not quite. They say, I heard you once went on campaign with Napoleon. And he says, I did indeed. Would you like me to waste 50 pages telling you everything I know about Napoleon?
Oh, Lord, okay.
So we just have a lot of that. So, look, it's not great, okay? But if you're interested in really racking up your Balzac, you know, count, throw it in, I guess. But it's a passable one.
Does it at least make good use of realism? Is it like, in the sense of, you know, he's one of the fathers of realism. Is it very detailed analysis of the society, or at least even detailed?
Yeah, I mean, we do get to see the society. We see the way this doctor has helped the society, and it's nice to see some of the details that we do see. And if you're a big fan of Balzac or of that type of literature, you might find some merit in it. But honestly, like, don't make it your first Balzac. You know what I mean? There's no need.
Yeah, I mean, our first Balzac was old Father Goriot or Le Père. That might still be.
Yeah, it's still the one to start on, I think. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah.
So the library. Oh, go ahead.
No, don't forget, guys, that Balzac, he wrote every day. He just woke up around in the evening time, drank coffee, kind of stayed in bed and wrote till 6 o'clock in the morning and then fell asleep again. It didn't have the most healthy lifestyle, and probably at some point quality must decrease if you're writing every day, just nonstop. I mean, yeah. I'm surprised he wrote so much good stuff, you know. That's all I have to say about Balzac.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very fair comment. I then read a second Balzac from just a couple of years before 1830, and this one I preferred a lot more. This one, however, was more... It's called The House of the Cat and Racket, okay? But actually, the collection I got, these are novellas. So there's actually a couple of different novellas within the collection. So they may not all be from 1830, but that's the volume that I had. Mm-hmm. Cat and Racket itself, just to sum it up very, very briefly, there's a nice chap who's got he's got a guy working for him, and he's a very kindly master, and he says, "Look, I'm very good with you, but I think you're not being good with me because you're not telling me the secrets. I've told you the secrets of the till and how to run the shop. You're not telling me the secrets of your love life, good sir. I believe that you're in love with my daughter, and I'm happy to elevate your position in society." And it turns out he loves the wrong daughter. There's two daughters.
Oh, no.
And then it's a shock. He can't go with the youngest daughter because the oldest one has to be married first. So we get into all of that kind of thing. But he reconciles them to it. And in the end, he says, okay, you can marry the daughter and you'll be very happy. And I think he's inheriting the shop as well, or some money from it or something like that. So it's nice to see good people who aren't trying to swindle each other, which you get in a lot of these books. You know, it's a nice, kind master.
Yeah, because the divine, I keep saying Divine Comedy, the Human Comedy, it's really a lot of the themes in it are money and manipulation of power. So it does repeat in all the novels in some sense. Often they're poor characters, or they're trying to act as if they're rich, and they're trying to get power over someone. And yeah, that's just something like, you know, this kind of social ladders off, it just repeats itself in many folds in all of these works. And remember, the Human Comedy, I think, consists of about 90 novels and more than 40 unfinished novels and a few plays. No, sorry. Yeah.
There's a lot that are just a title or a fragment, kind of not a book that's actually done as well. Yeah, I think about 30, exactly. 40, as you say. Yeah.
It's still worth reading because this really started the whole kind of big masses of novels that are linked. You know, this whole kind of historical kind of novels that became popular later on. This started.
Now, listen out for it, because I'm going to just touch on a couple of these novellas, and you're going to catch a very important link in a moment. But that's really all I have to say about the actual main one, House of the Cat and Racket. It's just a nice story. The other sister goes off and marries some count or some aristocrat anyway, and she's a lot an artsy type, and she's a lot less happy with him because he realizes a year into the marriage, well, we've got nothing in common. You know, you were pretty and I married you, but I'm an artsy type and you come from like a merchant type background and we don't have anything in common. Yeah. And then the granny or the aunt says, "You seriously let your husband lock himself in rooms with naked women and you're fool enough to believe that he's drawing them and doing nothing else, madam." I took offense at that as someone who does do life drawing.
yeah, indeed. I can imagine.
But no, it was a funny one to some extent. Second one in the series is about a dance, and there's nothing to say about this. It's a very, very short one where they're arranging a dance. The only reason I bring it up at all, the dance at Sioux. Okay. The only reason I mention it is because at one point, in a totally throwaway line, they mention, "What have you got against Monsieur de Rastignac?"
Uh-huh.
And they say, "Well, Madame de Nucingen has made him her banker." And then they just move on. So just a little throwaway line to some of the old characters that we know from Père Goriot and from the other books in the collection.
Okay.
Then my favorite, The Vendetta. So this one is very nice. This girl comes into her father, and the father's very possessive, and he's very much, you're not allowed to ever leave me. You can't have a husband. You can't have anyone. Stay with me. Your dad loves you. But he's very, very loving, but very controlling and possessive at the same time.
Okay.
And he eventually says, you can marry when I'm dead. And she says, well, why do you want me to wish for your death, father? You know, because I've met a guy that I really like. So they introduce the guy. And of course, doesn't it turn out that the guy Ginevra likes is an old vendetta that the family had against each other. And they'd had murders between the two families going back generations. And so the father disowns her and kicks her out with the husband. And then, well, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it's very, very, very sad and tragic. But this was the best one in the collection, The Vendetta.
Just because of the story, or did you?
Yeah.
Was it also? Yeah. Yeah. It's the kind of story you would like it.
The story is very good. The tragic ending is very sad, very, you know, very Balzacian, really.
Totally.
But also just the whole thing about the vendetta, that they don't realize this guy, Luigi, is the same one from the other family, is kind of funny when it first comes up as well. So it's kind of tragic and comical and does a lot of things at once. And
That sounds more like Le Père Goriot kind of stuff.
Yeah. At one point, the father's going to kill his daughter with a sword. He doesn't, but at one point he's considering it because she's in love with the rival family.
You know? You like that Dumas kind of story.
I do. I really do. So there's a couple of other brief ones, but those are the main kind of two or three. Oh. So that is how far I got with Balzac. And we've got one last Balzac next month, and then we're putting him to rest for a good while.
Until you start the rest of the 90 novels or whatever it is. Yeah.
Okay. Would you like to go ahead with one?
Maybe you could start a whole separate show, just like Balzac.
Balzac Boys.
Monthly. Balzac Boys, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the first book I read, a lovely book. Have you ever heard of the Moomin Trolls?
No.
So the Moomin Trolls are, they're from Tove Jansson, who's a Swedish-Finnish author. And they're written in the 40s. So basically they're this kind of like troll-like figures that live between Finland and Sweden somewhere. And they're based on Scandinavian figures. And in fact, trolls, they do appear in Peer Gynt from Henrik Ibsen.
Okay.
Our big hero.
We talked about.
Indeed, yeah. But anyway, this is a famous children's book in Scandinavia and also has been translated in many languages. And I read the second one, which was Comet in Moominland. Now, the reason why I read the second one is because most people, in the series of 9 books, most people start with the second one. The first one wasn't published till way later on into other languages.
Right. So you start from number 2 usually.
Start from number 2 is Comets in Moominland. And this is a very lovely book, I'm telling you. This is a really philosophical kids' book, beautifully written, and just very strange, actually, in a very positive sense. It's a kind of book. When you ask me, for example, what kind of book would you like to have written, this would be among them, I'd say. When you read Tove Jansson, you do think about Astrid Lindgren, for example, who wrote Pippi Langstrump.
Sure.
We also covered last year. And in fact, both characters appear in the 40s, just after the Second World War. So they're very parallel characters. Whereas Pippi Longstocking, sorry, I said Langstrump. Whereas Pippi Longstocking is a very kind of independent, strong character. The characters in Moominland, they're all flawed. And right. That's a beautiful thing about it. They all kind of have their strengths and weaknesses. So we start off in Moomin Valley. The Moomin family, they're just settling into a new house. And they're living with this kind of kitten, kind of like figure called Sniff. And Sniff, he goes off to wander a lot. And he finds things in the forest. And he then plays with the main character, with Moomin. And they go off in their little ventures. But something happens that disturbs them, which is that a comet is flying into Earth. And everyone's very worried because it's a huge comet. And a friend of them told them that this will destroy the Earth. And they become very worried because Moomin and Snifter are basically these young childlike figures. So the parents, to put them at rest actually do what most parents don't do. They actually let them leave their house and go on in their adventure because they think an adventure will cure their fear. Now, and this is very interesting because this was written in 1946. So for me, it's a bit like, you know, kids worrying about the H-bomb and the atomic bombs and everything. It's that fear was probably present in the 40s.
Yeah.
Anyway, so these kids, they don't stay at home worrying. They go off on an adventure. They go on a raft and they head towards the sea and they head towards the observatory. They know somewhere is an observatory. It's not explained how they know it. They just kind of seem to have this intuition. And they head off to the lonely mountains where there's an observatory. And there they meet a very strange figure. They meet Snufkin, who must be one of the best characters ever created for German literature. Right. He's basically this little wizard kind of elf fellow who lives a very minimalist life. He kind of just, he doesn't own anything. He just lives on a raft when they meet him, and he has a harmonica and a hat, and it's just kind of, he's just kind of living life. And he decides to join them spontaneously, and they go off together to go to the observatory to observe the comet. Now, and I find this interesting. So you got three figures. You got Moomin, who's very much a child. So he's kind of, he decides when he wants to do this, he does this, but he also gets bad humored. But in his friend Snifkin, the cat, he always wants to possess things. So he's kind of in love with a normal kitten, I should say. And he says, well, if I want to have you, I want to own you, please come to me. And Snufkin, on the other hand, actually teaches Snifkin that that you don't need things.
How are you not getting confused with Snufkin and Snifkin?
I just got confused there, I think. it is very confusing, actually, I admit. all right, but aside that, though, there's a lovely passage which really impressed me. It's Snifkin, hopefully getting, no, not Snifkin, Sniff. That's why I got confused. Sniff, the little kitten fellow. He goes into a forest, and he discovers like red diamonds.
Okay.
He says, oh, wow, red diamonds. Oh, I can at last buy all the things I've wanted. I can press my little kitten friend and she'll be mine. And he's always like wanting to own. And he's like collecting all the diamonds. He can't even bring them up because it's like, he's so bogged down by all the diamonds. He can't even go up the hill again. And all of a sudden, like this huge lizard appears behind him. And terrified, he escapes, leaving every single diamond behind. And when he's back on top, Snufkin, the wizard fellow, and Moomin, they didn't even bother going down. So you got Sniff, the kitten fellow who wants to own everything, just crying and saying, oh, I wish I had those diamonds. And Snufkin, the wizard fellow. This is very confusing.
It is.
Snufkin the wizard. Let's just call him Snufkin the wizard. He says to him, there are way nicer things in life than carrying luggage around with you. I like to keep things in my head and then I can revisit them whenever I want to. So he's kind of showing him that you don't need things, that owning things bogs you down, makes you heavy, makes you always worried. And this really reminds me a lot of the Tao Te Ching. Now, if you remember the Tao Te Ching, from Lao Tzu, 2,500-year-old meditation book, where it teaches the same thing. When you own things, you get scared of losing it. And this fear also causes depression. And even in the lovely book that I want to recommend, A Short History of Humankind by Harari, he discusses that depression seems to have appeared in humanity around the same time they started owning things.
Okay.
But like possession and owning things seems to like leave you with anxiety.
Makes sense to a degree. Yeah.
Yeah. So that went off. The story went a bit off there, but I just wanted to highlight that this whole book is really a children's book with a lot of philosophy and observations like these. Without spoiling the ending, they go to the observatory. They see the comets. It's a bit of an anticlimax because nothing happens then at all. They just said, okay, we saw the comet. We know the scientist tells them exactly when it's going to hit. It's going to destroy Earth. And they just go back. They go back depressed to their home. And this is where it goes really strange. The comet is coming closer. The sky color has changed into red. The ocean has disappeared. And they travel back home, not by boats because there is no ocean. They have to use big, long sticks and they kind of jump over the muddy floor of the ocean. And it's really bizarre. The story ends very strangely. I won't tell you, because I don't tell the ending.
Of course.
But let me just say this, that it's a bit like in the film Don't Look Up, which I really recommend, where it's also the world is going to the end. They kind of just decide that it's okay that they're going to die, which is a very strange thing for a children's book. But they go in trust, I like to say, because the wizard fellow, he's got a little trick up his sleeve. He's got something which is basically anti-flame. So this might save them from being baked alive from the big comet. So they decide to go into a cave, which Moomin and Sniff discover at the beginning of the book, and they think they might survive the destruction of Earth. Something unusual then happens, which I don't want to spoil, but I can tell you it doesn't end up depressing. So it's still a children's book ending.
Okay, good.
But it's quite a lovely philosophical ending. I think the message of the book, if anything, is just, you know, rather becoming anxious, just love every moment. And especially if you know you're going to die, it's the whole memento mori. It's like, you know, remember that you must die, so live now. So they really do live carpe diem, memento mori.
Are we sure that the message of the book hasn't got something to do with confusing similar names?
It might have to do with that as well. Then, yeah,
that's the real moral of the tale.
That's the second message. Get your names right. Exactly. Now, I love the book, so I really recommend it. I didn't want to spoil too much about the ending, but it's just going to leave... You're fascinated by these characters because you've got like trolls figures, you've got like talking animal figures. You know, I love all that, to be honest. What I love, for example, Winterset Hollow or about a Okutama Express, my novel.
Yeah,
I always love these animal figures that represent maybe also a virtue or vice. They're often very symbolic. And you know what the strange thing of all is that in the 40s, I was just reading, I'm not sure how scientific this is. This might be a bit pseudoscientific, but supposedly an astronomer did discover a comet that could have destroyed Earth in the mid 40s.
Right.
And it just went off Earth. So it didn't go near Earth in the end. But it's just a strange coincidence. Tove Jansson supposedly, after hearing that, said she didn't know about it, but it seemed a very strange coincidence because it was released almost in the same year this observation was.
It's very interesting.
Just for LBQT listeners out there, Tove Jansson was a very open lesbian in a time where it's actually considered illegal in Finland. And she comes from a Bohemian background, and she just openly said this. And I think there are definitely some themes of that in the book as well. So it's very popular with the LBQT crowds. Highly recommended for everyone out there. Totally.
Cool. Sounds good. Well, before I go into anything else I've read, we might as well quickly just say hello to anyone listening on Radio Oxen or also on the TNC podcast network. And thanks to all our friends. And of course, booksboys.com is where you can get a website where you've got links to all our social medias, our Patreon, and all the other things that we're involved with, different places you can listen to the show. We've both been moving around a little bit, though. I don't know if we mentioned, you've relocated to Germany.
I have indeed. I'm in Dresden now. Lovely city. I believe it used to be called the Eastern Paris. It used to be called before the war. Then it was destroyed and rebuilt by Italian architects. That's the irony. And it's actually beautiful. It's a beautiful city. Highly recommend it. And I love culture. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Dean, we posted a video of this. I keep crossing like old telephone booths where people put their books in.
Yeah.
And you can just take them. I've seen at least two of them. And there's always like books that people always leave like their books in boxes and they put them on the street and you can just take them.
Mm. You put a video of that very popular on our Instagram. We really took off on Instagram there. I think in the last month, we've gone from 900 to 1200 followers. Wow. Some of those videos were getting like 20,000 views, things like that. So we've got very popular.
Thank you very much, everyone, for that was just a spontaneous video. I wasn't expecting that. Mm. Thanks to Alisa, she just filmed me and... Thank you.
And also, I have not moved anywhere, but I have a lot of little trips planned, mostly to different parts of Spain, little tours around Spain in the next month or two. And our Playboys co-host Alex has moved off back to United States for a few months. So we're all...
But he'll be back, don't worry.
He'll be back.
Don't
worry, we're all getting around and moving and doing various things.
We are a mutual friend. We're very fond of him. We don't want him too far away. He's at the other side of the pond, but he'll be back very soon, don't worry.
So the next things that I did I read two Spanish. Well, sorry, no, I didn't read any Spanish books. I read two books in Spanish.
Yeah.
None of them were Spanish books. So the first one.
Can I guess Dumas, Balzac?
No. Patrick Susskind, El Perfume.
I'm very amused that you read a German book, not in English. Well, it would be better translated probably, but in Spanish. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know where this book came from. It's been on my bookshelf for some months. And
I love that book.
Did it magically appear? Maybe it was part of the last care package of books that Valerie the Pigeon Detective sent me. Maybe I bought it sometime and forgot about it. I don't know, but it's been on the shelf. So eventually I just decided to read a German book in Spanish.
Mm. Well, yeah, not in English yet.
First time I've ever read a German book, actually.
Really? Okay.
I can think of, yeah.
Patrick Susskind, just a bit of background information for everyone, is renowned in German for being a real eccentric, like a proper reclusive eccentric. He actually doesn't show himself to the public, really. He's released only, really, I think, three novels. Not only, but he's released three novels and some essays. He keeps himself quite minimal, but the stuff he's written is gold's worth, and I think the perfume is amazing.
This is a bit more modern for my usual tastes. We're talking as recently as 1985. 80s,
right? Yeah.
But I really loved it. I really loved it. So we've got this chap, Grand Wheel, and he essentially is... We see a little bit at the beginning about when he's born and the kind of the midwife thinks he's got a demon kind of possessing him, and the priest or whoever says, don't be silly, like, don't worry about that. And then we skip ahead a little bit, and he encounters this guy, Baldini, and he's working for him in a perfumery. At the start, you sympathize with the guy because he's very mean to him, and he kind of treats him like a dog, you know, and like a servant and a slave. And he's very rough with him, and he's always kind of telling him off and, you know, telling him to shut up and, you know, don't interrupt me, you know, you're beneath me and all this kind of thing. So you feel for him at the beginning, like he's being treated badly, but he is learning the trade of the perfume.
At the beginning of the book, it makes it clear that it shows a very cruel depiction of French society, of society in general. It's really It's kind of more like the Thomas Hobbes perspective of humanity, not Rousseau. It's really like man is wolf to man. Yeah.
Yeah. But we see that, and we see that he wants to learn about the perfumes, and that he really has a good, keen sense of smell, and he can smell people. And, like, you know, there's this girl that he's in love with because he can smell her, and he's really attached to that. And he has the best nose in Paris, they say.
Yeah, literally.
So, well, literally, yeah. So there's this popular perfume going around called Amor y Psyche. I don't know. I guess that translates to love and psyche. Yep. And they want to try to recapture that, because that's the current brand. And Baldini's a bit old. And he says, well, in my day, people were happy with just violet fragrance. And now they want all this love and psyche. And
just to make clear, was this before the French Revolution it was depicted, or after? I can't remember now.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's just, I remember it's kind of like turmoil around the corner, yeah.
But Grand Wheel says, well, I can remake this perfume, and he makes it perfectly. So then they realize, right, you can make perfume for us. But at the beginning, all he can do is follow instructions. He's great. He can smell something and say, I can remake this. But he can't design his own recipe, you know. Yeah. So he works through some things. He gets very sick, and he eventually convinces Baldini to let him out of kind of, not his contract per se, but to let him go. And he says, like, I'm doing this work, but I can't figure out how to really distill the essence of something. And they realize, oh, there's other techniques that I haven't taught you that other people can teach you. So off he goes. Then there's like some kind of disaster in the town, like a river floods or something, and some houses fall into the river, including Baldini's, and he's never seen again. I thought Baldini was going to return later as the villain, but I was completely wrong. He's gone, and Grand Wheel is the villain.
Totally.
And look, I'm not going to go massively into what happens, but I think that everyone should read this one, to be honest. There's parts where he's living up a mountain as a recluse. There's parts where there's murders of all the young girls in the town. And, you know, he's distilling their essence, essentially, to make...
It was very surreal, that.
To make a perfect perfume. There's a part where they're gonna finally capture him and arrest him, but he releases this kind of killer perfume smell that brainwashes the whole town. It gets very strange.
It's amazing. I think that scene, without spoiling it, I was 18 when I read it, and I never... I was almost going to spoil something, but let me spoil it just slightly. I've never read like any depiction of an orgy-like scene
Yeah,
that happens.
There's a full orgy depicted.
Yes, and I thought that was very kind of, I mean, it becomes so dark, and especially the cave part. The cave part is like really like he's like in Plato's cave, or like in Nietzsche's Zarathustra's cave. You know, literally just he's just there, and he's just enjoying smell. He's just smelling. He doesn't live. He just smells, and for like ages.
It's almost a curse to him at one point, you know. But what he wants to do is nothing admirable. At the beginning, we think he wants to just learn to be the best perfumer in Paris. But he kind of gets this obsession with capturing the essence of like these beautiful young girls, to the point where the whole town have got to lock up their daughters literally for months, you know, and it gets a bit crazy.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. I mean, no wonder this was Kurt Cobain's favorite novel, supposedly.
I did not know that. I
mean? Yeah, that's I mean, it makes sense. I like to also say something about the original German novel. It's one of the most beautifully written books in German as well. So as well as the story being incredibly weird and unusual, the prose is sublime, actually. Wow, well, I'm glad you read it. Highly recommend it.
The next book that I read, also in Spanish, but also not Spanish, and you'll notice that I'm moving forward in time here. We've just hit 2005. How often do I read a Noddy's book? It's Lunar Park by Bret Easton Ellis, which I also read in Spanish.
That's crazy, because I was just going to say that, I was just going to mention, and I didn't, that if you like perfume, if you like Patrick Süskind, you probably like American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm wondering, like, you know, Patrick Süskind, you know, Patrick, I'm wondering,
maybe
the 1991 novel, Patrick Bateman, was influenced by him.
Well, PJ, how's your German translation with names? Does Süskind translate to Bateman?
It translates literally as sweet child, which might be so ironic that he's called sweet child. They just make Bateman.
Well, this book is, you know, it's interesting.
Now, I'm very amused, because now you read an English book translated into this.
I know. I don't know what's going on. the pacing, I don't know where this one came from either. But the pacing is weird in this book. The first maybe quarter, I was really bored. And I thought, goodness, why am I reading this?
Oh, no.
Because it's a fake autobiography. So the first quarter, I think, has more real details before the crazy stuff starts happening. So it's just dull. And then it really picks up, and I'm really, really enjoying it. And I'm really loving it. But still, by the last quarter, I'm like, okay, we can finish now. This is getting, we don't need this to keep dragging. But I did enjoy it overall. I've got to be honest. You know, I mean, I like the guy, right? I read American Psycho. I love the book. I love the movie, you know. So this is essentially the grittier version of American Psycho. Because American Psycho, it's very overly romanticized. You know, look at the movie of Patrick Bateman. He's a bad guy, but you love him. Well, this is similar, but you don't like him. So Bret Easton Ellis, he's not great with his family, with his kids. He's cheating on his wife. He's taking drugs. He's doing all the similar things that Patrick Bateman did, but you realize that it's kind of depressing and not fun. He also talks about the book, about American Psycho. So he's in the book. He's playing a fictional version of himself. It is an autobiography, but it's fake. So he talks about, you know, American Psycho and the success of that. You know, he's going and doing interviews, all this kind of stuff. And he mentions that he based Patrick Bateman partially on his own dad. And he had a bad relationship with his dad. Now, not that his dad was like a Wall Street stockbroker, but just some of the negative aspects of the character rather than the superficial kind of aspects. So there's some stuff like that that comes in. He's there with his partner, two kids, one of which is his and one of which isn't, but he's raising them anyway. And he has good intentions and he's trying to do a good job. But they say, like, you're always in a bad temper. You know, you're just not a nice person. They go into like some couples therapy. He's not sure if he gets on well with the kids. He's struggling with certain elements of just domestic life, basically. And with his dad as well. Then he starts to notice all this weird stuff. Like the house they live in is like 307, and 307 was the time that his dad died, and all this kind of stuff. And there's all these weird coincidences, and he thinks there's a curse on the house. And he meets this guy Clayton, who wants to be instructed by him, because he's also teaching one day a week at the school, literature. And then they realize, well, there's no student called Clayton in the school. Who is this guy? And Clayton turns up to a party dressed as Patrick Bateman, and they can't find him. They can't track him down. And the girl that he's cheating with, Amy Light, appears with Clayton, and then they never see her again. And then all these kids in the town are going missing. And it's like, what is going on? This is all crazy. And then does his son know about the missing kids? It's just a lot of weird stuff happening. But ties to American Psycho again, with people going missing and murders and things, you know?
Yeah.
And the detective, Donald Kimball, the same name as the detective in American Psycho, turns up and he's investigating. And then this guy's phoning the police saying there's like monsters in the house and the police think it's just his dog and all this kind of stuff. So there's some supernatural elements. He thinks that something's connecting him with his dad. He gets like a seance, what's it, an exorcist type person to help him. And of course, it turns out that the house isn't haunted. He is haunted. He is the problem. And it's like personal issues and personal demons and all this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of just wacky stuff going on, but it's grounded in reality at the same time.
Right, okay. Interesting idea. So like starting off as a biography and then maybe going beyond that into fiction. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, he was very influenced by, he does mention that he loves Ulysses from James Joyce. He said that. He said he was fascinated by it. Yeah. And essentially, Ulysses is that. It's kind of like a one-day biography of James Joyce, highly fictionalized and then made bizarre, especially towards the end. Yeah. So really, it sounds like he was influenced by that idea,
You know, if that's, it seems like it, yeah. And it's a really enjoyable book, but it is a bit random, to be honest. And, you know, the not too happy. I'm not going to spoil the ending, of course, but the ending's not too happy either. You kind of, it doesn't all work out nicely, you know?
Oh, no, that's sad. Well, okay,
there's not a massive amount to say about it. If you like American Psycho or if you like any of his books, you might want to give it a try. Just see your way through the kind of boring first quarter. It's just, you know, it's nice because it gives you that slow burn of starting with reality and then gradually a little bit of supernatural stuff come in, a little bit of stuff that are from American Psycho come in, and you just kind of, you know, his domestic problems and things sort of all kind of unravel. So it's just a really cool concept, to be honest. And I did really like it.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, I still like to read it because I really love American Psycho. Also, Bret Easton Ellis, his new book is coming out in January next year.
I didn't know that.
The Shards. So it's been a good, it will have been a good 13 years since the last publication.
Yeah, I didn't know still writing, to be honest.
Well, yeah, so good for him. Like, I'd like to still give it a try. And the stream of consciousness, was that there, like an American Psycho, again, influenced by Ulysses?
Yeah.
Okay. That kind of random, kind of just nonstop kind of talking. Yeah. That can be enjoyable. Or as you say, that can be a bit like, where's this going? Or even you lose track as you do with Ulysses again. So yeah, I can imagine it being off-putting and interesting at the same time, or both.
It's got pros and cons, you know, like any literary style, you know.
Cool, cool. Awesome. Well, let me tell you about the book that I read. I briefly mentioned this little book here. I'm showing you right there. It's called Nimm's Leicht, which means something like take it easy, take it lightly. I'm trying to translate. Take it easy, take it lightly. As just as much a serious as well as a practical observation from L'Oreal. This sounds like a philosophical essay from the 15th century, but it's not. It's a little comedic little book with some illustrations and kind of like kind of just, I don't know, like observations from life that.
And whose advice are you?
This is by L'Oreal. So a bit of background information. L'Oreal is a comedian.
I was hearing L'Oreal, the hair product company. You know, we're both into our sexy hair.
Oh, indeed, yeah. Well, this is not L'Oreal. This is L'Oreal. So I get it right. So L'Oreal is I enjoy L'Oreal very much because he's a comedian that my grandparents would have loved. My mom, for example, doesn't. Very old fashioned, kind of early 60s, pre-hippie, just observations of life, little illustrations. This doesn't need to be translated. This is just a book of illustrations. He's a comedian. He just wrote this book of illustrations.
Okay.
Which is just make me laugh. It's just stuff like but what is it? It's like I can show you one. It's kind of like a picture of someone playing a cello and then accidentally sawing the cello in half.
Right. So there's no text at all.
There's a tiny bit of text. There's a little observation here, for example. Here, there's basically rhubarbs, and there's a face of a rhubarb,
right.
And it gives him like a whole little biography, how it becomes an influential publication.
Have you found an interesting new way to sneak in the ninth art, PJ, to sneak in the comic
book? To sneak in the comic book. I, you know, I've been trying desperately to do that. And it's very hard with Dean because he always put, he likes his classic lit. So indeed, this is comedic ninth art. Highly recommend it. Don't need much German for it. L'Oreal, take it easy. Take it lightly, excuse me, not take it easy. And I do want to talk about the novel I've been reading since then. Now, to be honest, Dean, I'm only a quarter of a way finished because this novel is almost 900 pages long. Making it longer than Anna Karenina or Ulysses. It's the seminal modern classic, excuse me, going back to the 1980s. I don't know why we're going so, excuse me, not 1980s, no, 1992, which is maybe the most important years of our lives. It is
We were both born.
And this is a year after American Psycho was released, the one and only, the indescribable. Well, I'm going to try and describe it.
But I hope so, because the show wouldn't be great if you didn't.
I just leave it like that. The majestic, the one and only, the magnificent. I hope I'm selling this. The one and only, The Discovery of Heaven by Harry Mulisch. Now, have you ever heard of this lovely chap?
I don't know it. No.
Do try to
describe it.
I do. I will try. Try to describe it. Harry Mulisch belongs to the Great Three. So three authors who, after Second World War, were considered the seminal authors of post-war Dutch literature. We're going to Holland. We're going to the Netherlands.
Okay.
And over here, we've got Harry Mulisch. And these three authors, really, the Great Three, they're really a bit like Germany has this exception, has this obsession, and Poland, Central Europe has this obsession with Second World War, and that's completely understandable. Yet they kind of can't seem to forgive themselves. The Germans don't ever forgive themselves. The Polish are just traumatized, so they just rewrite the stories endlessly, which makes also sense. But the Dutch have a very strange kind of perspective. They're both victims, and they both feel guilty because a lot of Dutch people, as well as Austrians, collaborated with the Germans. And Harry Mulisch's dad was Austrian, collaborating with the Germans, and his mother was a Jewish woman from Belgium.
Right.
Whose parents were put into a concentration camp, and his father didn't do anything to stop that. So, yes, not exactly a happy family constellation. They did divorce before the Second World War happened. And Harry Mulisch famously stated, "I am the Second World War." Meaning that he seems quite traumatized that his own dad actually, although his dad actually managed to save his and his mom's life by interfering, didn't seem to bother doing anything about the grandparents.
Right.
Jewish side. And he's in a very odd position, Harry Mulisch, growing up, being half Jewish, half Christian, half, half betrayal, half survivor, half hero, half villain. And in his books, these themes appear over and over again, but his seminal work, and this most people agree as well, is the large work called The Discovery of Heaven. I don't even need my I don't have the book with me right now, but I don't even need it. It made such a big impression.
Mm-hmm.
What I've got to say about this book is that we've got Max and you've got Ono, and these two fellows they become best friends. But how did they become best friends? By divine intervention. And this sounds like it's going very Christian and all. It's not particularly religious, the book or anything like that. But it does say the premise that angels interfere to make, because they need a savior. And they need a savior in Max. So we got this one angel interfering for 70 years. And he actually, this is crazy. The angel actually makes World War One happen on purpose because he needs the parents from Max to get together and make him, because supposedly, I haven't finished the book, but supposedly World War One is better than whatever would happen.
The alternative.
If Max wasn't born. And so
I have to ask PJ, are you going to finish this and update us next month? Or
indeed what? I will. Yes. I won't get too long.
It sounds really good.
Yeah. And then to be fair now, 800-900 pages, there's no point. It's probably good that I'm doing this in two parts. And, It's got a lot to say in the book. What I find fascinating is this constant reminder that Harry Mulisch's background really is Max's background. So Max, the character who's supposed to be the savior, he doesn't know this, but the angels have made it so that he will be a savior.
Okay.
Has the same background, slightly worse. So Max's background is that, again, Jewish mother and Austrian father, but the Austrian father actually didn't bother saving the mother in this alternative biography of Harry Mulisch.
Right.
A bit like we just mentioned with Redis and Ellis, kind of a fictionalized biography, I suppose, for dramatic effects, worse, right? Because the mother actually was murdered by the father.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's Harry Mulisch is Max in this character, in this book. So it starts off with this angel talking about, with this kind of like, it's not really God, it's somewhere like between God and archangel.
Right.
And it's unusual, I'd say. It's not really what you'd expect from angels. They take it all very stoically, what's going on Earth. And they're not particularly kind of like, oh, isn't this lovely being in heaven or anything like that. It's more like an office job for them.
Sure.
And
reminds me of The Good Place a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose it is. And it has comedic elements to it. So it's not really just like this Second World War thing, whatever. This is not a Second World War book. This is a book set from the 60s to the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's constantly about the Second World War and about Max not really handling the situation very well about his background. So you got Max and you've got you've got Onno. By divine intervention, they just happen to meet in the oddest circumstances. And it's the whole book is about if this didn't happen, then this didn't happen. So we know this, but the characters don't notice. So we've got an interesting, almost divine perspective looking down at these people. So it's an interesting already structure of the book. So it starts off in 1967 in Amsterdam, and they meet just outside Amsterdam. Max gives Onno a lift in the middle of the night, and they just know instantly that they are basically soulmates. They're both really, really like overly intellectual and sarcastic, and no one really gets them. But now these two, they just get each other. But they're very different. Onno is very introverted. He's constantly thinking. He's not really looking at the outside world. He's just thinking. He's kind of like a language genius. He's always like his head is. It's kind of like it's. His head is always kind of in the clouds. But Max isn't. Max is really living in the now, and he's actually. Max is always flirting with ladies, and he's even his appearance is very. He's very meticulous, whereas Onno, the introvert, is very messy and, and dirty. And yeah, so they're both opposites, but they become best friends. And the book is very enjoyable, I'd say, for anyone who's into history and literature and philosophy. It really makes a huge amount of references to.
So it's ticking some of my boxes here.
yeah, you'd enjoy it because you get all the references, I suppose, if you read. These are really. Well-read people, they're kind of like, I'd say they're a bit outside. They're outsiders, I suppose, because they've gone a bit too much. Like it's just like no one gets what they're talking about. And but it's beautiful because we get the references. At least you get the references if you're into that. It might not be your book if you're not into it. But if you're into that, you get the references, and it makes a great portrayal of the world actually from the late 60s to the 80s. That's what I love.
Okay.
So they go to, jumping ahead a bit, they go to Cuba, and you can see really Fidel Castro. You meet a lot of famous people throughout the book that appear there, and it's very interesting. Without getting too much into it, they become best friends. But after half a year, and they quote Hegel. This is what I love about it. They constantly quote someone. And, oh, yeah, I didn't even know Hegel said that. Hegel said something along the lines of, wasn't it beautiful when it lasted? The summer of the light or something like that along those lines. He was talking about the French Revolution. Hegel was very enthusiastic about the French Revolution. And he said, oh, wasn't it beautiful in the spring? Sorry, not in the spring of our youth. And then, yeah, the French Revolution turned into more tyranny. And they kind of both, these characters kind of mentioned that. They kind of know that their friendship is falling apart actually after half a year. And it becomes a bit... confusing when Max falls in love with a cellist called Ada, who then nevertheless falls in love with Onno. And so you have one couple, but then she leaves Max and is with Onno, and now it's like, yeah, a bit of tension, I suppose, there. And whereas Max led up to that point, led a very light life, full of just kind of sleeping with women and just actually enjoying music and life. Now is where he starts to worry about his father and mother after he visits Auschwitz and you really get a real insane kind of capital, insane chapter, not capital, of that whole kind of Krakow and Auschwitz. And depression starts to enter his life and they become a bit more risque in what they do and how far can they push their own intelligence. And the point on which I'm at is they're in Cuba and they're in a Congress. They've managed to somehow accidentally end up in a revolutionary kind of rebel assembly.
Right.
But it's becoming really dark now, actually, because Ono is actually now just about to betray Ada, even though he's actually a very loyal friend and boyfriend. But he just falls for a woman. And you can also tell that on a parallel level, Max is getting into the old alcohol, even though he never drank before. And yeah, it's almost the end of the first part of the book, which is the beginning of the beginning, it's called. So
okay, so you kind of stopped at a good point.
Yeah, because I know the next part is called the end of the beginning, so right. We'll see how it goes.
Well, I can't wait for a wee update next month because it sounds very intriguing.
It's highly recommend it even now because just of all the crazy references. Max is an astronomer. Well, I had to mention that. So there's a lot of kind of like Big Bang mixed up with is there a God and Auschwitz, and it's all kind of crazy. And
okay, it sounds like a lot of different kind of stuff coming together. I like the sound of it.
Totally.
Well, I just want to mention, just on the topic of history real quick, I have started a new history class. I'm now doing the history of 19th century Ireland. So I just didn't have enough things to fill my time, PJ. That's
yeah, I just think the last course on how to make wigs with Agatha Christie just wasn't enough for you.
Yeah, I had some free minutes in my week and I just thought, no, can't have that. Well, look, let me move on to the next book I read. I was very startled.
Intermediate golf course was Bill Shakespeare, that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's not enough.
I was
planning for your next trip. Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.